You're listening to Sean of the South, and I'm your host, Sean Dietrich. Coming to you live this week from the King County Pie Eating Competition, where 23 young men have gathered to show us their insatiable appetites. The music here behind me is the Red Cedar Review from Charleston, South Carolina. Aaron Firetag on the mandolin, Brian Edwardson on the guitar. I'm going to say it just like this. I hope you get a bowl of ice cream today. Not just ice cream, but peach cobbler. Hot from the oven, and may you eat the two together, thereby enjoying the pleasant, albeit unique, sensation of hot and cold at once. That's what I wish. Also, I hope you feel filthy rich today. Not rich in money, per se, but you get the idea. Kind of like leaning back in a lawn chair and enjoying pure easiness. When everything seems simpler than it should be, like skipping rope on the moon, hitting home runs with a tennis ball, fishing in a fishbowl, or playing the game Operation without batteries. Today I hope that a dog stares at you with big eyes that seem to say, "Pet me, damn it." And I hope you give in, because dogs don't do this for themselves. Also, I hope you see something big today. And by big, I mean something vast. A field, an ocean, a clear sky, a Dairy Queen. And I hope it overwhelms you for a moment. The kind of feeling that makes you think about things that are more important than bank accounts. Last night I stood on the beach at midnight, watching the Gulf of Mexico. And that dark water seemed to go on for billions of miles, as though I was standing on the doorstep of heaven itself. "Sean," I imagine the Almighty would say, answering his front door, "hath thou happened to bringeth me any ice cream by chance?" And there I'd stand, dumbfounded before the creator of the universe, and I'd say, "You bet I did." You never visit heaven, you see, without ice cream. Anyway, I'm not finished. I hope your email quits today. I hope your phone dies. I hope the internet goes out. And I hope to God you enjoy it. I hope you get a handwritten letter from someone who you hadn't heard from in decades. I wish you the sensation of winning a baseball game when everyone rushes onto the field in dog piles with their pals. I hope for some reason you reach the verge of happy crying today and then start laughing for no reason. I wish that you would lay in bed with someone you love, talking about things you've never thought about before. I pray the sky puts on a colorful sunset for you tonight. I guess what I'm trying to say is I love you, no matter who you are. And I really, really hope that you get that bowl of ice cream. It was around New Year's that I remember my grandfather boiling sausage on the stove, standing over it and poking at the links with a fork, making sure they were done. And I remember him telling me a story about his own life. My grandfather got home from World War II after spending several months in an R&R facility in Italy. Now, the R&R facility was a place where men who'd seen the horrors of war were supposed to learn valuable skills which would help them assimilate into civilian life again. Such valuable skills like basket weaving, or gin rummy, or bingo, or cross stitching. But it was in Italy that my grandfather bought a mandolin. It was a mandolin that was shaped kind of funny. He'd found it on a street market while he was walking those old streets, And there was a little old man who was the craftsman of these instruments. He had guitarellas and all sorts of Italian traditional instruments. And the mandolin was hanging, and my grandfather knew what a mandolin was. He had played a little bit back home, but not much. He picked up the mandolin, and he played with it. Since he was a good guitar player, it was easy to him. And they bargained on the price, and my grandfather took the mandolin back to the R&R facility. And there, even though he had a wounded arm, he learned how to play songs like Turkey in the Straw and Ashokan Farewell and Dixie. His friend Daniel was there with him. His friend Daniel had gone down to the very same market and bought a guitar. And in that R&R facility together, they worked on music to wounded men recovering from the atrocities of a battlefield, playing music that their granddaddies played, the kinds of music that link us to our ancestors somehow, old songs. My grandfather loved the old songs. He loved songs which connected us through history. And while they were playing this kind of music, they got to know some of the Italian musicians in town. And these Italian musicians taught them how to play songs like Ritorna a me and O sola mio and Bolare and other songs that I cannot pronounce. But my grandfather could sing because my grandfather had a glorious tenor voice. My grandfather had grown up extremely poor. And one of his first jobs as a young man was singing at the local radio station. He would go to a radio shack with a large tower poking off of the sheet metal roof. The shack was in the middle of a wheat field, and my grandfather would show up on Thursdays with his old guitar, and he would sing into a microphone that looked a lot like a snuff can, and it was gospel music. He could sing every song in the hymnal. My grandfather was wounded in his armpit after the war. His armpit. And when he got home, people asked him about it. I asked him with a sort of caution that young men who've never been to war use. How'd you wound yourself, Sam? And my grandfather would be leaning over his Chevrolet, polishing that engine, and he'd give one-word answers. He could be a quiet man when he wanted to be, and war had changed him and made him more so that way. And it is impossible to piece together a man's story if he's only giving you one-word answers. So the general consensus among local youth was that my grandfather had been captured by vicious Nazis. And one of the German soldiers, during a hand-to-hand combat struggle, had tried to shoot my grandfather in the heart by pressing a revolver into his armpit. And this was the story that young boys like to tell each other. In the R&R facility, while they would play songs together, my grandfather and his good friend Daniel, they became good friends. He carried the mandolin back to the States when he came back, and he would play at the local water hole every now and then for small town people who sat on bar stools. He was good. He was good. Not great, but good. It seems like our culture has put a burden on young men to be great. It tells them they ought to have all sorts of accomplishments and all sorts of accolades and a nice reputation that's built from doing famous things. Young men are instructed that they ought to be great and not just good. One of my grandfather's most famous attributes had nothing to do with his talents, even though he was one of the most talented people most had ever met. He looked like John Wayne, and that's what everybody said. In fact, I have old pictures of my grandfather, old pictures of him, my grandmother, and he looks just like the Duke. The same sideways grin, the same head tilt. He had that same walk, a stiff-legged walk, like he was leaning forward, about to fall flat on his damn face. And when he wore his uniform, he looked like someone who was important. Army Air Corps uniforms, he used to say, could make the janitor look like he was important. Of course, my grandfather had been a few steps below the janitor. He pumped gas at a country gas station after the war. He sat on a wood chair and he leaned against a clapboard service station, and he would fall asleep in between the cars. And when a car would roll up, a LaSalle or a DeSoto or a Chevrolet, they would honk their horn once, and my grandfather would be jostled out of his sleep. He'd stand and he'd wash their windshield, and then he'd fill them up. They'd ask directions to the city, and if they were nice, he'd give them the shortcut. If they were abrasive, rude people, he'd give them the long route. There was once a man who was driving a delivery truck, and he was running a little behind, and he was rude to my grandfather, and there were few sins that were worse than rudeness among my grandfather's generation. He was running late, and he was in a panic-fueled frenzy, and my grandfather offered him a shortcut into town, only it was no shortcut. Actually, what it was a series of dirt roads which interconnected and were only known to the rural people of the region, and when finally followed in the succession my grandfather had told him, it would lead into a dead-end cow pasture. They found that man's delivery truck stuck in the mud, and it took two trucks strapped to the axle of his truck to pull it out of the mud. My grandfather. My grandfather's guitar-playing friend Daniel got transferred to California. He liked it. He'd never been to a place like California, a place so big, a place so dry. There's something about Californians, they act like everything in their weather is better because it's dry. And to a southerner, it's not understood because we can't remember what life was like when our underpants didn't feel like we had a soggy pancake in them. Down here, summers are wet and winters are wet. Everything is wet and we're used to it and it feels quite unfamiliar when we're not there. But Californians say, oh, we have dry heat, as if that's better than wet heat. Oh, we have a dry cold, as if that's better than a wet cold. It's not, at least if you ask me. I've been to California several times and in my opinion, both the heat and the cold feel like the edge of hell. After several years of living in California, my grandfather's friend Daniel visited town for the holidays. On New Year's Eve, they were together. Together, it was a small party in my grandfather's living room. And it was like my grandfather was in another place and time when he got to spend time with Daniel. They say he was happy. At least as happy as a man like my grandfather could be. My grandfather had had a hard life. Ever since his father had died, his life had been a series of unfortunate events and scrambling to try to make enough money to survive. My grandfather had sent a check home to his mother every day of his life after he joined up, right up until the day that she passed. They told each other, my grandfather and Mr. Daniel, how they were doing, and they talked about their life, and they told stories that both of them knew by heart, and they introduced each other to their children and to their wives, and they drank beer on the porch, and they told each other about the dreams they used to have and about how these dreams never came true. And Daniel, Mr. Daniel, looked at my grandfather and said, Sam, you're never going to believe this. I've been waiting to tell it to you. But you're never going to believe this. My grandfather took a sip of his beer and he set it down and he said, what is it? He said, you're just not going to believe it. I almost don't believe it myself. Now my grandfather was beginning to get worried. His thick, dark eyebrows made this concerned look that wrinkled his forehead a little bit. He said, well, what is it? Come out with it. He said, John Wayne is going to be filming a movie not far from my house. It's going to be a Western. It looks like the desert where I live. Yeah, so what? Said my grandfather. So I told some of the movie executives about you. I drove onto the set one day and I told them all about you. About me? What did you tell them about me for? Oh, Sam, I told them that you look just like John Wayne. That's what everybody's been saying since I met you. I showed them a picture of you. I showed them a picture that I had of you. And my grandfather squinted his eyes and said, "Well, what happened?" He said, "What happened is they want to meet you, Sam. They want to meet you. They thought you looked just like John Wayne." I know the exact picture that Mr. Daniel showed those movie executives. It's a picture of my grandfather dancing with my grandmother at the USO dance. They had just met. My grandmother was a rural girl, and she would attend these dances as a teenager. They were too poor to afford nylon stockings, so her girlfriends and her would draw a thin line up the back of their leg, up the calf and up the thigh, to make it seem like they were wearing nylons. It's amazing what kind of tricks teenage girls can pull off with ink pens, even in the early 1940s. My grandfather sat on the porch and he looked at Daniel and said, "You mean to tell me that people in Hollywood want to meet me?" He said, "Hand to God, Sam, hand to God." My granddaddy hopped on an Air Force flight to California. Back in those days, it wasn't hard for an Air Force man to hop a flight and fly wherever he wanted if he was willing to fly in a cargo plane. He met Daniel at the airbase, and when he arrived, Daniel drove him through the city. They went to a cafe. It was a small cafe which was made of an old train car. At least it looked that way. It was bright polished chrome on the outside with bar stools trimmed in red vinyl. And they sat and they had coffee. And the movie executives came through the door. My grandfather could tell them right off they had double-breasted pinstriped suits and fancy shoes. One of the executives looked at my grandfather and said, "Oh my God, that looks like the Duke." Movie executives gave my grandfather a ride in a Cadillac Seville to the Duke's Airstream trailer parked in the middle of the desert on a makeshift movie set which sprawled out like a city. There were tower camera cranes, and there were trailers parked in rows and semicircles. There were vehicles of every kind and jeeps rigged up with cameras hanging off the front. There were horses in stables, and there were makeshift towns that looked like an old western village. My grandfather looked out the window and said, "They led my grandfather and Mr. Daniel to an Airstream trailer, which was polished to a mirror finish. My grandfather said when the sun would hit that Airstream trailer, it would blind you. You can't imagine anything so bright," he said, "as the Duke's Airstream trailer." They walked into the trailer. The Duke wasn't there. My grandfather said the trailer had a refrigerator full of Coca-Cola and a full stove and a pots and pans hanging from the walls and a full bed in the back which was made, which had frilly lace pillows on it. And there was even a bathroom. And after my grandfather had sipped enough Coca-Cola, he went straight to the bathroom. He walked into the closet-sized water closet. He shut the door and he took a leak in the Duke's toilet. Until then, the most famous thing my granddaddy had ever done was take a leak in Paris, France, behind the Eiffel Tower. A few of his friends had wanted to do something big with their life, and while they were in Paris, France, they decided that they would mark some of the great landmarks of world history. And while I can't be certain, I do believe my grandfather also made his urinary mark on the Arc de Triomphe. But I can't be certain. This was big. My grandfather was the kid who could have done great things with his life, but never got the shot. He had the looks. He had the musical talent to play anything. He was an artist who could carve figurines out of blocks of pine with nothing but a pocket knife that was about the size of your pinky. He was smart. He had a mind that could remember things that he'd read after only taking a glance at them. But the war intercepted his talent like war did back then, a man who could sing like a bird and pick his guitar something fierce, who never became what people in his small town thought he would become, was peeing in John Wayne's toilet. The Airstream trailer door opened, and the men in suits stood up, and Mr. Daniels stood up, and it was John Wayne himself who walked into the trailer. My grandfather stood at attention, making double certain that he had zipped up his fly. The Duke wore a ball cap and sneakers. My grandfather could hardly believe it, looking at him, that the man who embodied the spirit of the American West, the American cowboy, was wearing a ball cap and sneakers. And when John Wayne removed his cap, my grandfather was in for another shock. The Duke had hardly any hair on top of his head. Now, in the movies, John Wayne had a full head of hair, and he had sharp, brilliant blue eyes. But this man who was standing before my grandfather looked like any middle-aged man you might pass on the street. The Duke walked close to my grandfather, and he eyed him up and down real quick, and he said, "Who the hell is this?" You'll have to pardon me, that's the best John Wayne impression that I can do. The men in suits explained that this was the man who could be your stunt double. "Don't you think he looks like you?" they said to the Duke. "Don't you think he favors your appearance?" The Duke just squinted his eyes and shook his head and said, "This son of a bitch doesn't look anything like me." If you ask me, my Duke impression is getting a lot better as the night goes on. And so my grandfather, safe and secure in the knowledge that he had just urinated in John Wayne's trailer, exited the Airstream, and they were heading back home. But the men in the suits stopped Mr. Daniel and my grandfather and said, "Wait, would you like to be extras in the movie?" My grandfather and Mr. Daniel looked at each other and shrugged and said, "Why not?" They put Mr. Daniel and my grandfather in the movie, and they let him ride a horse. And my common man grandfather was dressed in full cowboy regalia, riding a horse only feet away from John Wayne himself. And they let him keep that beaver pelt brown hat. And even though that hat had a sweatband which never touched John Wayne's hairless head, I remember seeing my grandfather take that hat off and say, "This is a John Wayne hat." My grandfather wore that hat one night while I watched him carve a figurine on the front porch. And the wood chips which fell around his feet were pine white colored. And there was an American Western magazine on the porch, face up, with the image of a buffalo on it. And my grandfather would glance down at the magazine now and then to make sure he was carving the right shape. I've seen that movie my grandfather's in. I've seen it more than a few times. My grandfather and his friend Daniel are the tiny, tiny little extras in the corner of the screen for only a few seconds who are riding the American painter horses. Mr. Carl, who owned the movie theater, rolled that movie three times the first day. And each showing was a packed house. And when my grandfather and his friend Daniel were on the screen for their few tiny moments of glory, the tiny little figurines riding the American painter horses, the entire theater clapped and cheered. It was one of the bigger moments of my grandfather's life. Before he died, my grandfather had seen that movie at least 1,000 times. He could quote lines from it, and he could tell you everything about the weather on the day that it was filmed. He could talk about the wardrobe trailers and the flamboyant film managers who fit he and Daniel into their costumes. He could tell you about the dry, arid California air and tell you, "I don't care if the weather is dry, it feels like the edge of hell." Yes, it was a high point in my grandfather's life. Not the highest, but high. and it made him proud. And whenever anyone mentioned the Duke's name, someone would always get my grandfather to tell the story. And on the day of my grandfather's funeral, they told that story at his wake. I sat with white-haired men and white-haired women, and I listened to them talk. And it was one of the first stories to circulate through that small group of people who gathered to remember my grandfather. A white-haired man with wrinkled skin and liver spots on his face was there to tell it. His name was Mr. Daniel. And on that sad day, the day that a common man was laid to rest, people didn't talk about the 21-gun salute where seven men fired three volleys into the air. They didn't talk about the American flag, which was folded 13 times into a triangular shape, then presented to my mother. They didn't talk about the sound of the trumpet playing taps in the distance and how people cried. They didn't talk about the wound in his armpit, which nobody was really certain how it had happened. They didn't talk about how a cheery boy raised on a dirt farm who'd survived a Great Depression had gone off to war and returned a different man, a man who rarely smiled thereafter. No, they didn't talk about that. They talked about the 30 seconds of cinematic film which bore the image of my grandfather's face. The man who looked like somebody famous, but never was. A man who could pick a mandolin. A man who got pulled over on the interstate by a policeman when he was in his 70s for driving too slow in the right-hand lane. Whose small pine wood buffalo figurine sits on my desk. A man's life is not measured by the accomplishments he's made, if you ask me. It's measured by his friends. It's measured by the beauty of his family. And this new year, which we're about to go into, a lot of young men with ambition will wonder the same things my grandfather wondered long ago. They'll wonder if it's really about the famous things you do in life or the attention which you get from others. But if my grandfather were here, he'd be the first to tell you, this life is not about the accomplishments you have. It is about the memories you make. And most importantly, it is about the famous places where you have taken a leak. Thanks for listening to Sean of the South. I've been your host, Sean Dietrich, and it has been a pleasure this week. Hope you join us next week. That music here behind me is Brad Edwardson on the guitar and Aaron Firetag on the mandolin, the Red Cedar Review from Charleston, South Carolina. To find out anything more about what I do, you can visit seanofthesouth.com. And while you're there, hope you drop me a line, because I'd love to hear from my friends. And speaking of friends, I hope you don't take life too seriously. Sure, the early bird gets the worm, but it is the second mouse who gets the cheese. Adios.